Hi, this is Andrew Torres from the Opening Arguments Podcast, and you are listening to Inciting Incident Podcast because you are wearing a belt.
Choose the news they want now, but we
people
overcome
choose the
that.
Facts they want now. I don't mind being dejected and rejected, but I'm not gonna be ashamed about it.
I can do that.
See, Joey, that's the beauty of argument. Because if you argue correctly, you're never wrong.
The truth and a lie are not sort of the same thing.
Good evening. It's Friday and it's 7 p.m., which means it's time for the Inciting Incident Podcast, supported by our patrons and available on Libsyn, Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Android, LiveJournal, Google Plus, The Hard Harry Show, News Radio, WHP 580, Rock and Emily's bed radios that are somehow appropriate for children that age, most tin cans connected with string, Tumblr, Snapchat, Zanga, LimeWire, WinMX, Napster. We'll have to spell it with two Y's there to escape Big Brother. The DCI, the Enchantment Under the Sea Dance, the plate in Pete and Pete's mother's head, and any other podcast app that somehow escapes this list. And now, here's your host, Al Lehman.
Good evening. It's Friday. It's time for Inciting Incident. This is episode number 62. And joining me is a professor of mine and someone whose books I read long before I actually took his class, Professor Bruce Kuklick. Thank you for joining me. And
good evening.
Yes, thank you very much. You know, we've sort of been talking. I know I stood out to you because of my baseball jersey, and we'll certainly get to that in a little bit because that's how I know who you are, is just the baseball book that I've read that you wrote. But first, can you sort of give us your background, how you got here to Penn, and what drove your interest in history, sports, that kind of thing?
I don't know if I can tell a story that includes sports, but I can tell a story that... We'll show you why I got to Penn. I was an undergraduate here in the early 1960s, and I got a scholarship that took me to England. I was the first person in my family to actually go to college, and then, of course, to go overseas was a big deal. And I was there in 1963 studying philosophy, and I was at Oxford, England, when Jack Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. And I basically, as a lot of people were, was I was basically completely shook up by the assassination and wondered why on earth I was studying the meaning of the word good, which was my philosophical topic over there, when the world looked like it was going to hell in a handbasket. So I came back. I ultimately, in fact, very soon, left philosophy and got into the study of what was called at Penn at the time, American civilization. What has stayed with me from that time is a deep interest in the study of American politics, which then got reinforced because I was a graduate student during the Vietnam War, and all of the political questions I had about the United States were focused by a concern by what was happening, not just in Southeast Asia, but also what was happening at home domestically to produce the reaction to the war. And that did it. From then on, I was a historian. I taught, after I got my degree, I taught at Yale for 4 years. Detested New Haven as a small town that was socially snobbish and conservative. And then I got offered a job back here at Penn, which I snapped up. And I've basically been here ever since.
So there's sort of that Ivy League elitism that is such a cliche that people always talk about, and it sounds like it's kind of the opposite up there in New Haven, or at least was at the time.
No, I would just say I'm all for elitism, I must say, but Penn is elite enough. Yale and I think Princeton strike me as being over the top in there, not in the form of elitism which they embody, and I'm probably being very unfair to Yaleys and Princetonians, but I feel more comfortable in a large urban environment. And I also think of the Ivies, Penn is the most vulgar. It used to bother me that medicine, law, and Wharton were so dominant at Penn, but I've come to think of that as an aspect of the university which in some ways brings it down to earth and makes it more desirable than some of the Ivies, which are intellectually even more rarefied than the University of Pennsylvania.
So what you're saying is there's a lot more different kinds of studies that go on here that are very prevalent. Is that what you mean?
Yes, that they're prevalent and that push Penn in a more practically oriented direction.
Okay.
And as I said, I used to think that was bad. You know, it was vulgar. Now I feel more comfortable about it because it seemed to reflect the realities of urban America.
So it's more, it would be more accessible to someone from the outside, like myself.
I would think so.
Okay,
yes.
So if I had gone to another school, I probably would have found it more off-putting than coming here.
I would say that if you had gone to Princeton or Yale, that would be true.
Well, then I'm glad I made this decision because I've enjoyed my experience so far. Since you became a professor, besides history, I know we're taking a class that combines history and cinema. What drove your interest in that? What specifically stood out about the use of historical film that made you want to connect those dots?
Gee, Alex, I wish I could answer that in a way that was satisfactory to me. For a long time now, I've been off and on interested in movies and their power to reflect certain historical truths and to convey them to students. Maybe I can make sense out of this. My father was one of the early people who made home movies. And we have home movies in our family that date back to the 1940s, believe it or not. So that's about 70, 75 years old now, which we've now, they're converted to other forms than the old 8 and 16 millimeter films that he had. But when he died, I kind of took over the family role of taking home movies. I kind of got minimally skilled in making movies, and I've kind of converted all of our stuff to DVDs. And that was became part and parcel of my interest in movies. And then in the last 5 or 6 years, I really got interested. And in fact, what propelled this course that you're taking is a book that will be out this fall on American movies during World War II. So I kind of got into it, but it's also part of the fact that I just kind of followed my nose as a historian as to what I think is important or interesting. So although I do have this real commitment to politics and to diplomacy, I wrote the baseball book because I interested in popular culture and baseball, and then movies. I wouldn't even call it cinema, and I don't pretend to know about avant-garde European movies. It's the Hollywood film, you know, even the blockbuster film, which captures the attention of millions of people, is of concern to me because I think of it as, you know, having the ability to grasp people's attention for a long time.
So do you think this visual medium takes historical events and makes them accessible to people who either didn't experience them or who did experience them and are reflecting on it based on what we learned after the fact?
That certainly can be true. Some people aren't interested in history movies, no matter how well they're made. I think some people are much more interested in reading books about, you know, historical episodes. But I do think that Hollywood plays an important role in conveying certain things to a lot of people in ways different from the way books or lectures do. I haven't worked out, you know, whether it's more important or less important, or the extent to which everybody is grabbed by Hollywood, but it's certainly a component of our historical thinking.
Okay, and I think it's important to say that, you know, the film itself is a historical document, not only on what it's portraying, but in what was going on
yes.
at the time.
Yes.
And you can see that as historical films evolve, as we
yes.
learn more things. You know, a film about World War II in the 60s is
right.
not the same as it is now.
That's right.
And
as I will point out in 3 weeks.
Of course, of course. So for those who don't have the privilege of taking this class, what changes? What is it, because we get more access to information? Is it because the people making them are more distant from it? What is it that evolves among these historical films, and how we change over time?
Well, the one major thing that evolves are real advances in the technique of filmmaking. And I would say that's the primary driver. The second thing that happens is that, I would say, because of the work of professional historians, our understanding of some events changes. So, for example, the recent film Lincoln, I think, is very different from previous renderings of Lincoln in the movies, in part because the techniques of filmmaking are so much, you know, more sophisticated and interesting, but also because Doris Goodwin wrote a book called Team of Rivals,
mm-hmm.
Which makes a point that a lot of historians know, that one of the things that was most effective about Lincoln's management of the war is he put together a group of Republican politicians who were always at one another's throats, but had a larger commitment to the prosecution of the war. And so you get the Spielberg's Lincoln, a rendering of the war which tries to show the conflicts within the Republican Party, which still were overcome by the general commitment to end slavery. And you don't see that so much in previous films about Lincoln. So it's a reflection of the changes in the historical understanding produced by old-fashioned professional historians. At the same time, Ms. Goodwin can't duplicate what Spielberg did. I mean, there's something different about the visual representation of what's going on than what you get in reading a book.
Absolutely, and I think the most famous rendition of Lincoln before that was probably the one based on the Gore Vidal book. I believe it was in the late 80s, and Sam Waterston portrayed Lincoln.
Right.
And it's night and day.
Yes.
You know, in that version, Lincoln's very confident and very, you know, prestigious. And in Lincoln, the Spielberg movie, he's awkward and high-pitched and nervous all the time. So it's really fascinating how our images of these people change over the time as we learn more things. But, you know, sort of transitioning there, you know, especially with that era, one of the things that I've noticed in this current election season, this current political atmosphere, is that the arguments we're having are nearly identical to the ones we're having right now and back then. So a lot of the rhetoric that
back then, you mean?
Well, in the 1860s, in the time of Lincoln, you know, especially around slavery, I've noticed a great similarity in the rhetoric about why we needed to keep slavery against a lot of the arguments that are going on right now, especially with Donald Trump, about the resistance to progress, about how we need to make things the way they were. Why is it that this country seems to have those same arguments with different people so often? What is it, just the way it was designed, or is it because we never actually solved those problems?
Well, first of all, I would say I don't necessarily want to sign on to the notion that the debates of the Civil War period of the 19th century are structurally similar to what's going on today. But what I will sign on for is the fact that a political culture after a certain point has a certain character, and it never gets over whatever problems it has. That is, the same issues in one way or another keep coming up and keep getting regurgitated. And what I, maybe to make your point, I would say the problem of race in this country is one of them. From the time that slaves are first deposited in Virginia in the middle of the 17th century, there are issues between the Euro-Americans, the colonists, and the African-Americans that they bring here. And these issues are fraught, they're terrible. A number of people have called them the original sin of American politics. I don't know whether you want to go that far, but what I would say as a historian is that you can see the problems generated by this attempt to bring together two different ethnic groups in the New World in the 18th century has evolved and revolved and changed, but it's always there and it's never solved. There's never an end point. It's not like a football game where you get a touchdown and you stick the ball and it's 6-0. That doesn't happen. The game doesn't end in politics and culture. But this, as long as the culture remains, these same issues get brooded about and worried about and fought about and contested about.
Remember, when the Emperor looks naked, the Emperor is naked.
We're going to bring about our two sponsors here. First of all, our first sponsor from last week is, of course, Mind Aquarium with my friend Terry, who is an artist and doing some work for some of my other projects. Bring beauty into your home with Mind Aquarium, original custom art and prints by Terry Sheffield. Weird is welcome, which is perfect for this show. She's good people and does some very, very good work. I've known her for years, so you should definitely give her a like on Facebook. That is Mind Aquarium. She's fantastic. And we have a new sponsor from Dan Flanagan. We already gave him the rundown as well, but he is an official sponsor for Warriors of the Crystal. The trading card game is a loving homage to class-based JRPG games in card form. I have no idea what that means, but I'll take his word for it. Live your adventures in battles that include up to 4 players. Battles are dynamic, strategic, and exciting. Currently available are 4 theme decks, booster packs, and coming soon are 2-player starter decks. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Join the battle for Dios Crystal. Will you be the one crowned Crystal Champion? It sounds exciting. I know some of those words, but you should definitely check it out if any of those words mean anything to you.
Inciting Incident couldn't keep bringing you commentary, interviews, and fantastic guests without help from you, the patrons. You can support the podcast on a monthly basis at patreon.com/incitingincident, which gives you access to many great rewards, including a free t-shirt if you pledge $5 or more. You can also support the show by subscribing, rating, reviewing, and commenting. To contact them about ideas, guests, disagreements, fisticuffs, salmon slapping, rebel rousing, or just plain old tomfoolery, you can email them at incitingincidentpodcast@gmail.com. On Facebook, at facebook.com/incitingincidentpodcast, or yell into a tin cup and hope it's connected to one of our aforementioned string networks. And now, back to the show.
So there's always that cliche of, you know, the country's going to hell in a handbasket, we can't get anything done, we can't agree on anything, but we've never been able to agree on anything,
okay,
right?
Yeah, that's what I would say, yes. And I would argue that the same thing, I mean, you're getting me away from race, which is fine, but if you look at the founding, one basic fundamental, in which it was very hard to get anything done, because they feared that whatever would be done would reflect the illicit biases of prejudices or ideas of a group of citizens who didn't represent the whole. So the Constitution is structured so that unless there is a universal consensus, it's very hard to get policies to change. I happen to think that's a good thing, but I certainly think it's built into the system. And one of the things that I think historical understanding would allow people to grasp now is that all these complaints about how Washington is dysfunctional are somehow not to the point. It was designed to be dysfunctional unless there's universal agreement. And in the United States today, there's a big divide. People are at odds, at loggerheads. They don't agree about a lot of things. And the result is what the system intended when that happens. You don't do anything. You're stymied.
And do you think that's effective? Do you think, you know, when people are stymied, when they disagree on a lot of things, is it good that they are because it continues the conversation, or is it bad because we feel like we don't make any progress? Like, where does that fall in?
You're asking me to stop being a historian and be a political commentator, which I don't like, but I
Fair
will
enough.
Be. No, I will be. Doesn't bother me at all. I think it's perfectly appropriate. I would rather have nothing done than have a great number of the people disappointed because their needs or wishes or ideas about governance should be completely rejected. I think the standoff is perfect, and I don't see, to tell you the truth, that everything is so terrible that it demands action around the world or at home.
Okay. I definitely agree with you there. There's always this pessimism that seems to come up with the party that's not in power with people seeing others gaining rights and feeling like they've been disenfranchised. Uh-huh. But again, that's supposed to happen. That's kind of how the whole thing is structured. All right, so going back to history for a second to sort of put you back in that box, so to speak. Since you've been teaching history a long time, how have you seen your relationship with studying history change? And have you seen a difference with students interacting the same way?
Well, you're the one, you would be better placed to tell me what my, how students have changed or how what I do is pleasing or displeasing to them. It's hard for me sometimes to get a sense of that. But I would say there are two things that have shaped my approach to teaching. One is I've become increasingly passionate about the importance of history and the need for students to have some kind of historical background. I don't think you can participate intelligently in this polity unless you have some historical background. And this goes back to Jefferson in the 1780s, when basically he said, this ain't gonna work unless you have an educated electorate. Now, he meant something very different by what education was, but his basic idea was that people had to have some set of ideas about how politics functions for them to make reasonable decisions about how they're going to be governed. And I think we're in danger in the United States of losing much of a sense of that. So I'm increasingly passionate about trying to convey some aspects of American history to students. At the same time, and this kind of runs against that, is that I'm more and more skeptical of what history can tell us and what we can absorb and learn from it. I kind of have grown into what I would call a minimalist conception of history. That is, basically, what a study of history tells us is that the past has been an immense screw up. You know, we're lucky is the word, to have survived. And what we learn from, quote, learn from history, is that we're basically on our own and have to try to make our own best decisions. And that what we get from the past is a series of mistakes and mishaps and pratfalls and tragedies.
So there's a lot that you use that word lucky, and that often implies, I don't want to say a lack of responsibility, but that the general populace doesn't have as much to do with it as just kind of the driving forces. And I recently interviewed Noam Chomsky on the same similar kind of idea, but I would say he's of the opinion that more it's the people at the top intentionally making it that way, as opposed to just being luck or being outside forces that we can't control. How would you respond to something like that? Not to put you at edge with Noam Chomsky
anything. No, I think Chomsky basically has a very distorted, silly view of American history. His sin is one that I think is really endemic to a lot of people, and that is to take an ideological approach to the study of the past. He lacks the kind of skepticism which I think is essential to understanding history. That is that things are basically, I want to put this, there's basically there's just deep flaws in human character which makes our attempt at having a reasoned, rational policy always bound to fail. And that means that human life at best is going to be makeshift, that the extent that good things happen, they all depend on luck. That means that Chomsky is looking for too much rationality and order. God, I wish the people whom he claims to be the corporate elite who run things, I wish they did run things. I wish they had a better grasp of what should or should not happen. I don't think they do. Now, the problem with that view of mine that I take is that, as you suggest, it shrinks the size in which rational thought can get a grasp on what should happen. And it kind of says, oh, why bother doing anything? Things are going to go on the way they are without your diligent moral efforts to make things better. So I think, while I don't like where Chomsky comes out for various reasons, I also think that my view of things can amount to a cop-out and a way of saying, okay, I'm okay, I can't control what's going on.
So there's sort of a middle ground there that we're always trying to go toward, you know.
No,
that
I think
not too much
right.
that we don't have control over everything, but that at the same time, not everything is controlled.
I think you're right that I like to think one strives for a middle ground. But I think that thoughtful people often fall on either side, like they're either Chomsky or Bruce, although I don't want to equate myself with Chomsky. And I actually think it's the less thoughtful people who occupy that middle ground, like politicians, for whom I have a great respect, because their basic notion is not to think about these things and worry them through. Their job is to act on the imperatives of the moment in a half-assed way, trying to make things a little better, but realizing that their actions are such that they might not be able to foresee what will happen or what will not happen on the basis of what they've done. You know, in one of her famous addresses now to these Wall Street people, Hillary Clinton surmised that politics was like making sausage. I mean, it's a very nasty process, and if you see what went into it, you know, you wouldn't eat the chicken sausage that you get for dinner. And yet she goes on, somehow it maybe turns out all right. Now, I'm less sure that it turns out all right than she is, but you have to have people like her who are willing to make the sausage and think, okay, it's edible.
Right, and then you
and they're not people who are very reflective or thoughtful about things because they're too engaged in the processes of the workaday world.
Which would be the opposite of what Trump said in the debate last night, which was essentially, how come when you were senator you didn't control everything?
Yeah.
That's not
right.
how it works.
That's right. I agree with that.
And now to shift into a little more fun, so we sort of made our relationship start on baseball, and I want to talk about baseball, especially since we're in the thick of the playoffs right now. What have you been a baseball fan all your life, and is it just something that grabbed you from a historical and enjoyment point of view, or is it something that's grown over time? How what's your relationship with that?
Basically, I go back to my dad again, who took me to baseball games in Philadelphia, major league games, mainly the old Philadelphia Athletics and not the Phillies, who were nothing, from the time I was 7. I was a baseball fan until I discovered girls at age 16. Basically gave up baseball for a period of maybe 15, 20 years. And then when I had children of my own, baseball is a great way to instill in children, and you don't even instill it just happens, a sense of tradition, and it's a great way for children to have a non-fraught deep connection with their parents if they can bond over baseball issues. I mean, your listeners can't see my office here, but it's littered with all of these baseball memories of playing ball with my kids, coaching my kids in Little League and Babe Ruth, in going to baseball games, which were stuck into my head by my father, and then came to the fore when I had children of my own. So I've remained I wouldn't even say I'm a baseball fan, but as a lover of baseball as an extraordinary way of conveying and perpetuating local and familial traditions.
I can certainly appreciate that. A lot of my earliest memories are based around baseball. Yeah. I went to the World Series when I was 10 years old, and it was the first time Cleveland had been there in 41 years, I believe. Uh-huh. And I was just there with family, and because, like, hey, that team where I'm from is good. But I didn't have an appreciation for how rare that was, and I didn't have an appreciation for the moment I was experiencing until much later when I had my own kids that I could say, I was there, and we haven't been there since 97, so kind of wish I'd been a little older to appreciate it. But one of my favorite quotes is from comedian Dennis Leary, and he says, you know, I can't remember what I had for dinner, but I still remember the starting lineup of my favorite team.
That's right.
So I'm definitely right there with you in tradition and familial bonding and sort of the way, I don't even want to call it an escape, it's just something that we can go to that's the thinking man's game, the actions that take place, it's usually kept pretty classy. There's just so much to love about it, and it takes you a while to get used to the specifics, but once you do, I think you're hooked.
Yeah, well, there's a famous, I've forgotten who says it, but the quote is something like this: you begin at 7 years old gripping a baseball, and you wind up being gripped by the game. Which is, let me show you something. Show you this, my calendars.
Sure.
No one can appreciate this but you. But here's a 17 calendar. Look at this, January. Who is that?
Stan Musial.
Yeah. There's a, for those of you who are listening, there's a picture just of a number 6 on a St. Louis uniform. And everybody knows that, including my kids, who never saw him play, I did, knows number 6 is Stan Musial.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And my kids, because I've done it for them, can all imitate Musial's batting stance, which is known at the time as the Musial crouch. Now, how does that up in the big scheme of things? It's pretty minor, but if you think about what you can expect from family life and shared memories and ideas about tradition, it's pretty amazing that this guy from Denora, Pennsylvania, has managed to linger in American memory the way he has, and indeed got, at age 94, the congressional, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So,
for me, when I played, it was always Jim Thome with the long point and the balance. That was the one I always imitated. Yeah. So I can definitely appreciate that. There's just this transcendental experience once you're there that, you know, you start thinking of ordinary things in terms of baseball. Like you said, number 6, Stan Musial. Yeah. You know, for me, number 25, Jim Thome.
Yeah.
You know, Jacobs Field and the great teams of the 90s that I'm finally now getting a chance to hopefully see them make it again. So I don't want to take up too much of your time here, but if my listeners would want to read any of your books about baseball or otherwise, are there any particular ones you can recommend? Should they start with To Every Season, or is there something else that you would recommend?
Well, the only book of mine, I've written a lot of books. I would like it if they would read the book on the movies, which is called The Fighting Sullivans. Which will be out in a couple of weeks. It's called The Fighting Sullivans, How Hollywood and the Military Create American Heroes. But I've been down this road so many times that I know the only book that people of mine that people read and really get into is this To Everything a Season, which is the history of the Philadelphia ballpark.
Well, I'll be happy to read the Fighting Sullivans, excuse me, and I would encourage anybody interested in learning more about Hollywood and history to do the same. I want to thank you for taking the time to sit down with me here. This was a lot of fun, and hopefully we can talk more once the book comes out and I get a chance to read it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
The preceding podcast is owned by It's a Shameful Thing Lobsterhead, LLC. Copyright 2016, all rights reserved. The music is done by Elizabeth Drinks and was used with permission and was mixed together by Alexander Goodliffe. Copyright 2016, all rights reserved. For media or inquiries, please contact P.A. Torres at patorres.com.